You're listening to There Ought to Be a Law, the Center for Auto Safety podcast with Executive Director Michael Brooks, Chief Engineer Fred Perkins, and hosted by me, Anthony Simino. For over 50 years, the Center for Auto Safety has worked to make cars safer. Hey, listeners, welcome back to another episode of There Ought to Be a Law. This week, we continue our conversation with Professor at Carnegie Mellon University, Phil Copen. Welcome back, Phil. Okay.
Thanks. Happy
and for our
to be
listeners,
here.
We're just playing a game. We didn't stop recording from last week. There you go.
Good morning.
If there's any giant news, we've missed it. Sorry. So we're going to continue with unregulated cyber cabs. Before we even get into that, I see a lot we've pointed out over the last 6 weeks, say, Waymo's been on a real big PR kick, putting out a bunch of articles as much as possible, talking about how we are safer than every human possible. We're the safest thing. And they have this Swiss reinsurance company saying, yes, they are safer. We had on the show a couple weeks back, Missy Cummings, who pointed out all that PR stuff's really just for the Alphabet executives. It's not for people who work in the industry. It's not for consumers. It's not for regulators. It's for the people at Alphabet to keep the money spigot on. But the average person will read these things and go, okay, well, humans bad, Waymo good. Phil, why are humans so bad? I mean, well, what's this game they're playing with these stats?
All right, so there's two games. Well, there's three games. One is insurance and risk management is not safety, right? They're different things, but I think we're going to come back to that. Okay. One is that that they don't have enough miles to know how it's going to turn out. So if you go to, last time I checked, it's been a few weeks at this point, you go to the Waymo safety page, it says, in effect, and I've talked to journalists, had them read it and confirmed that they interpret it. It says, we're already saving lives. The sentence is a little more complex and compound, but the takeaway is clearly intended to be we are already saving lives. But if you go to their technical publications, you know, the peer-reviewed technical publications, it says there's not enough data to know if we're saving lives. The technical publication is correct. There's not enough data to know if they're saving lives. But when they say safer, they say, well, yeah, we're having fewer small crashes, but that's not the headline. The headline is saving lives, and they don't know. So we don't know how this is going to turn out. As simple as that, you know, safer as in we're having fewer minor crashes. Well, what do you mean by safe, saving lives? Well, guess what? There's a disconnect there. And I can make it really simple numbers. Last I checked, they were at 25 or 30 million miles or something like that, which is getting to be pretty impressive. But an average fatality rate is more like 100 million miles. So they're only a third of the way to the first expected fatality. When they get 100 million miles, they have low confidence. It's like 60 or 70% confidence. They need like 300 million miles to have 95% confidence. And a fatality the next day, throw this out all out the window. And by the way, going 300 million miles without a fatality is improbable, even if they are acceptably safe. So we're really not going to know for about a billion miles. And that's it. That's it. It's simple math. You're not going to know for a billion miles how it turns out. And if they said we don't know, but we're looking good, but we don't have the final answer, that would be honest, but that's not what they're saying.
But isn't that just a lower limit? I mean, they actually have to do much more because the version of software they're using to run the vehicles is constantly changing. And unless you've got a very, very disciplined very hard to understand technique for consolidating all those different statistical bases, it really gets even squishier. It really has to be much, much higher to develop that kind of statistical confidence.
So for the 300 million miles without a fatality, you're absolutely right, Fred. It could be that they just got lucky and yesterday they made a change that degraded them to be one-tenth as safe as a human. There's no way to know. So you're right. The 300 million miles with no fatality to prove 95% confidence is under extremely unrealistic and idealistic assumptions that are definitely not true. I would say if you have a billion miles, and so now you've seen a handful or two of fatalities across a billion miles, which you know, human drivers have that too. That's just how the roads are. But if you have enough adverse outcomes, you can build statistical confidence not on the projection of how often, but just, we've had 10, we've had 20, we've had 50 mishaps. And we've been changing software all along. You could make an argument that 10 or 20 or 50 mishaps bakes in their change control processes and everything else. You could make that argument. It might be a credible argument. But we are so far from having 100 billion miles where you can start to make those kind of arguments that's all moot. The answer is nobody knows how safe these things are going to be. And even the math that gets them to the earliest answer is unrealistically
Okay,
optimistic.
so let me divert just a little bit. I've looked into nuclear submarines, and you've got experience in nuclear submarines. There have been about 250 built since the Thresher went down, okay, in the institution of the Subsafe program. And Subsafe program does a great job of basically quantifying risk at the component level, enforcing people to use TRLs for appropriate risk management, and then assembling those into an overall vehicle, which has, again, a TRL level associated with it because all of the components do. And then running an extensive series of sea trials. And I think that most people would argue that the submarines are pretty safe, despite, they're ferrying around really explosive stuff. And the evidence so far is that even on this very small statistical base of 250 submarines, that they're, well, certainly safe enough the intended purpose because the sailors keep going out and using it. So is there some equivalent approach that could
So,
be
Fred,
used
you
or
look.
that could be recommended for vehicles to achieve the same level of perceived safety?
So, Fred, you left out the most important part, which is the maintenance and operational practices on
Sorry,
top of
my
that.
bad. Okay.
So that matters. Okay, so to let me back up. Subsafe. The USS Thresher went down, was submerged, and basically imploded with the loss of all hands back well before I was in the submarine service. I served on a submarine that was a sister ship. It was the same exact design as USS Thresher. And simply based on the declassified info that I've heard, by the way, there's an excellent video that came out a couple years ago when they declassified the mishap. I have a web page that is software safety less stories that you should know. We can put a pointer out to it. And there's a the Thresher points to a video by my old executive officer on my boat where he actually got he FOIA'd all the documents and went through and explained it all. But so it's well worth listening to. And the bottom line was that they had brittle pipes because they were brazing, which is kind of like soldering instead of welding. And the pipe burst, but they also had single valve isolation so that if a valve failed, you had a problem. And they had a bunch of engineering techniques that were designed for boats that only went 300, 400 feet deep, and they were going much deeper. I think they admit to 700 or 800 feet, and the Wikipedia page says 1,300 feet. That's really deep. There's a lot of pressure there. Okay, it's a lot of pressure that deep, and so the boats just weren't built for the pressure. They legacied design and construction techniques for shallower depths, and they didn't work on deep depths. So they went back and refitted all the boats with changing how they did the joints and putting in a second layer of isolation valves in case a valve failed and a bunch of procedures on how you run the reactor plant to make sure you can use the reactor to push you up to the surface even if your emergency air ballast tank blows don't work and a bunch of other things. But that was and that takes you through the sea trials you mentioned, Fred. But the other thing was anytime you touched one of those safety critical valves, you were pulling out a procedure. Only certified mechanics looked at it. There had to be someone reading and checking. And for a while, I was the damage control officer. I'd come by and check and make sure they were following the procedures. You don't just take something like that. It's like taking your car down to Joe's bait shop and submarine repair stand. You don't do that. It's comparable to what they do in aviation, that you have to be a certified mechanic to fix these things. It ends up the same place. And they do have an admirable safety record, but it's not just that. They It is also a very, very safety conscious mindset, extremely safety conscious. And again, in aviation, they try and get there, but SubSafe is sort of the leader in all that kind of stuff. It's an impressive program, but you have to really be prepared to spend a lot of time, attention, training, organizational effort to get there. It's a really special thing. It's very hard to do that when you don't have that particular culture and resources. And you know, by the way, the people maintaining this
Go down at it.
go down in the submarine, and they, like we used to say, you button up, you go down a few hundred feet, and if you want to freak out a visitor, you just look up and say, there's a lot of water up there.
I've watched World War II movies, like a lot of people, and those
Das
submarine
Boot.
movies are absolutely terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. I mean, a submarine with depth charges
Yeah,
dropping around
well,
you, I can't imagine.
yeah, never had that adventure, but Hunt for Red October is a pretty realistic
Yeah.
movie, and I'll leave it
Really?
at that.
It's
So,
actually a realistic movie, and I want to go watch it now again.
I one of the guys on it was a shipmate of mine. We spent hundreds of hours taking turns at a periscope. Yeah,
Oh, that's
it's pretty
awesome.
realistic.
No, sure.
I mean, not
Yeah.
the plot, obviously. Sean Connery, the not the English accent, not that stuff, but the not the plot, but rather the grit and the details and how people act and what they say, and it's
That's
very
interesting.
realistic.
So even if, kind of bringing us back to cars here, so even if we have this basis of statistical information that says these cars are safe, in quotes,
Yeah.
does that matter ultimately towards the real issue, which is whether these cars are going to be accepted by normal humans? I mean, is someone more likely to look at the statistics and that assuage their fears, and ignore, right?
Oh no. I mean,
It seems like they'd be looking at, the one crash that happened that year, or that would be much more persuasive to the average human as to whether these vehicles are safe.
so there's two paths here, Michael. And so this is a choose your adventure turning point, okay? One path is if you want to be technically safe, there's a whole bunch more you need to do beyond statistical safety, things like negligence and risk transfer, right? So you have to get all that right. And the other thing is ordinary folks don't know in as a practical matter, don't care about any of that, right? They care about other things. So let's do the second one first, and we can circle back to the first one if we want to. But the second one, I think, is more here and now, sort of in our face, right? Because most of the other things of safety, you're not until you're at 1 billion miles or so, you're really not going to know how they turn out anyway. It's all theoretical. What I think is that when you see something in the news, you're going to ask yourself, I'm a human driver. Would I have made that mistake? And if the answer is no, you're going to think the robotaxi is a bad driver. I think it's as simple as that. Now, that is a terrifying statement. Let me unpack why it's terrifying. But it's human nature. A cruise robotaxi had a woman underneath it, right? And that's a whole different story. I'm not going to go into details, but a woman trapped underneath it. It was at a stop. It decided on its own to start driving with her under the car, despite ample bumps and lurches and knowing it just hit her and drag her down the road. And then it stopped because its wheels were spinning too much, eventually stopped 20 feet later. And even the cruise commissioned external report said no human driver would have done that, right? And so the scary thing about that mishap, I mean, there are a bunch of issues about not being straight with the regulators and allegedly and all those sorts of things. But from a, do people think things are safe? If you say, what do you mean? You just hit someone and there was a good reason to believe they were under the car because your car wasn't even level. You're, up on top of them with one wheel and you decide to drive down the street. Are you kidding me? Right? And saying, but we're 7 times statistically safer for low severity mishaps, so we're safe. You have to give us a pass on this one. That's not going to work. Every time they see a computer driver doing something that a human never would have done, that's what they're going to focus on. And I think that's human nature. Trying to deny that is just not going to make it go away.
Right. So, Phil, the question I have for you is, can you define what safety is? Can you define what safety means? Not a.
Oh, that's actually the other branch with the seven things. So, but there's the technical definition, which we can get to, but there's the let me finish up with this public perception vision of safety, right? They're gonna say on a crash by crash basis, is that something I, as a typical human driver, would have done? And if the answer is no, then they're gonna have a safety concern. Now there's some problems. When I said that was terrifying, why? Well, most drivers think they're above average, right? We all know this. And that's actually that I looked up at one point a scientific paper. They have data on it. Like, most people think they're above average. So I didn't say safer than average. I said safer than they think they are, part one. And part two, Monday morning quarterbacking is a thing. So it's not only going to be what they would have done, it's going to be what they thought they would have done. And people are very optimistic about, see last week where he talked about how people have trouble performing in a crisis because your brain's just fritzing out on you, right? They're not going to be in the crisis. They're going to say, well, what do you mean you did this? Of course you're not supposed to. So of course you're supposed to know that the emergency release handle is underneath the mat, and why didn't you pull it up? It's like, well, you've obviously never been in a crisis if you say that, right? But in these, again, from last week, but for here, if the robotaxi does something a human thinks in a calm moment reading social media, that they, knowing that they're a nearly perfect driver, even though they're not, if they think they would have gotten it right, then the robotaxi company gets dinged for not being safe. And I'm not saying that's a fair standard. It's not an objectively reasonable engineering standard. But if you try and deny how people are going to behave, why would you be surprised that they behave that way? And you should. Why would you be surprised that people behave this way? It makes no sense that this is how people are going to behave. And if you want to succeed, you have to address that. You can't just pretend, well, you can't say, well, those people are irrational, so I'm just going to ignore them.
Well,
That doesn't end well.
isn't that exactly the approach that's behind the NTSB investigation of aviation accidents? They take the approach that any aviation accident that kills people is unusual and unacceptable. And then they do forensic analysis, and that has really contributed to a very safe aviation system. Don't we really need to kind of switch the appreciation of statistics around and say we're not really interested in the deaths per 100 million miles? We're really interested in the deaths today, and we want to understand those thoroughly so that we can make sure that systematic changes have been made to keep them out of the development system.
Well, so this is just my opinion, but I think the self-driving car companies are making a huge mistake and have been making it for years, selling on reducing fatality rates, because there's only downside, there's no upside. The upside is wait a billion miles and see how it turns out. The downside is every single headline that shows that people say, I would never have made that mistake. And so selling on saving lives is the stupidest thing they could possibly do, but they keep double, tripling, quadrupling down on it. Instead, what you're saying, Fred, I think is the smart move to say, hey, you know what? We're responsible road users and we're going to track the metrics, but it's going to be a long time before no fatalities. So we're going to track the metrics and look, check it out. Our metrics for minor crashes are looking good. So, there's some basis for trust, but their bigger basis for trust is when something bad happens, we're transparent about, yeah, we were 20% responsible as opposed, well, the other guy's 50%, so we're 0%, right? We were 20% responsible, and here's why it went wrong, and here's what we're doing to fix it. And here's why you should believe us when we say it'll never happen again, instead of, well, that'll never happen again because go away, stop bothering us, right? And so they could build a dialogue of public trust by being more transparent about not only the shortcomings, but also the fixes, so we believe it. Because what does NTSB do? They say, well, they have a mandate. I think they're required to investigate or at least consider every aviation crash. The automotive crashes are discretionary. But what do? They take a look and they say, is there a lesson to be learned here? So they take car crashes because it's a lesson, not because it's a car crash, right? What's different about this crash than all the other crashes? And if there is nothing different, they won't do much, or they'll say, see lessons 73 and 54 from last year. Guess what? Here they are again. But if they do an investigation, they find a root cause, and some people say, well, they blame the pilot and they're not reading the reports closely enough. Because the root cause isn't the point. The point is what's the recommendation. If you say, and I'll just make one up that applies generally, the driver was not paying attention because they were watching a movie, the recommendation is to put in a driver monitor system. So they're not actually blaming the driver, they're blaming the company for not having an adequate driver monitoring system by saying that's what you should be doing. So we talked before about self-driving cars need to enforce their operational limitations, the operational design domain, and they need to enforce driver attention. So NTSB might blame the driver for not paying attention, but blaming a driver doesn't fix anything. What fixes something is putting in a decent driver monitoring system. So you have to look at what went wrong, and I kind of don't care about the blame. It's not about the blame. How do you prevent the next crash? That's really the
Right.
only
You have
thing that
an
matters for
autonomous
safety.
vehicle. How do you blame the driver? Like, what do you?
Well, they
What
blame the safety driver. Uber ATG blamed the safety driver when they
Sure.
killed that poor pedestrian, right? That's or they blame a bicyclist for hiding
Right.
behind a bus. Oh, you hid behind the bus, or they blame, they always find a way, or the one that was just most laughable, they blamed a tow truck driver for not putting the pickup he was towing on straight, and therefore it was his fault for improperly towing a tow truck. Are you kidding me? Human, and this goes back to the principle. So okay, this is true. There's a tow truck going down the street with a pickup behind it that's towed at a slightly unusual angle, unusual presentation. Not one, but two Waymo robotaxis hit it on the same day, on the same trip. Okay? And they say, well, it's because this guy was not towing it the way we expected. Well, how is that his fault? And I'm reading, and I'm like, a human driver would never have said that tow truck's towing something I don't recognize, so I guess I'm going to hit it, right? I mean, a human driver's just going to find that laughable. Now, that's not quite the reasoning. I'm making a little bit of fun of it, but it's richly deserved in this case because they should have said, oh, we didn't train on that. We're going to look at all towed objects of all sorts and make sure we never hit anything being towed again. And we've learned our lesson. And no one was hurt, so, fine. But they didn't do that. They're like, oh, the guy was towing it a weird way, so it's his fault.
Well,
Come on.
the other thing I've noticed along this vein is that the NTSB takes 2 years between the time of an incident and the time it issues a report after they've gone to the trouble of developing root cause or finding root cause, developing recommendations, all the things that you've just mentioned. Yet I see the AV companies turning around a software update in, an hour and a half and saying, "Oh, we fixed that problem. Let's move on." Isn't there, do you have any knowledge about any of these companies actually getting down to root cause investigations and developing systematic solutions rather than just quick fixes?
Well, that's tricky because no one really knows if they're not in. Clearly, if you turn around a software fix in a week, you didn't do a thorough NTSB type root cause analysis. And maybe that's okay, but, right, the maybe that's okay part is if there's something that was clearly wrong behavior and you find it and you fix it, okay, fine. But you can't stop there. So in safety, if there's a defect that gets out and causes a loss event, you've got two problems. The first is you have to fix that defect so it doesn't do it anymore. Okay, fine. That you can do in a week maybe with some testing and whatever. The other question is, well, how did that defect get out there? What's wrong with our safety engineering process that we let it escape? We have to go back and revisit our safety engineering process, which may go back all the requirements. So for the Cruise robotaxi, it's easy to talk about them because they're not around anymore. It turns out that kind of mishap can be fatal to a company, which is another reason companies should pay attention. They had a blind spot, so to speak, in that they were not capable of modeling a pedestrian being hit by another vehicle. They saw the other vehicle, they saw the pedestrian, the paths intersected. They did not realize that intersection is an event worthy of notice or modeling. It just not, literally not a concept, okay? So after that, sure, you want to make sure that the car does not, after a crash, you want to make sure the car doesn't start moving again until a human remote operator checks in to find out what happened. They could say they fixed that pretty quickly, right? But the root cause analysis should find, oh, we don't model pedestrians being hit by other vehicles, and now we have to take as credible that can result in a person being thrown in front of us, which I've actually seen this happen. This is a thing. It's not a one-off. It happens all the time. All right. And so now we have to fix our system so it takes that into account, which is a big engineering effort. which is what you're talking about, Fred. So you can do a patch quickly. That's not the question. The question is, in the background, are they doing the engineering heavy lifting to go after all the things that contributed to needing to have that patch? And we have no idea, because they all say, "Oh, it's a software patch. It's fixed. Go away. We're not going to talk anymore." We don't know what happens after that. Now, companies like Waymo will say they're good actors, and they'll say in general, "Oh yeah, we go back to our test track and we do a bunch of scenarios and we do some modeling and simulation." And they say that generally, but you don't hear them saying that specifically for any
Well, the other
particular
thing
use of
I've
a patch.
seen, I've noticed is that several companies now say that they have a safety case analysis, and that's fine. And that, they'll wash their hands of that. But,
Yeah, ask
well,
them what they mean by
I
safety
mean,
case.
but
You have
whenever I
to ask
see
them what
that,
they
I
mean
say,
by
okay,
safety
well, how
case.
are you going to evaluate these? And what's the independent authority for, passing? And, how's that going to work? It's not enough to say we're going to build the Statue of Liberty. You're going to get into the details, saying where it's going to be and how it's going to get done and, who's going to be in charge.
Well, fortunately, there's a document that
Oh.
addresses all that stuff. It's called ANSI UL 4600, as you well know, Fred, because
Yeah.
we have talks about that. We're on that committee too. And what they'll say is, well, we have a safety case, but what few, not none, that's changing, few of them will say is it's a UL 4600
Right.
conformant safety case. And if you can't say that, we have no idea what you mean, right? Say, well, it sort of does 4600. Well, what does that mean? Who knows, right? And one of the things about having a conforming UL 4600 safety case is it requires independent assessment, and it talks about what independence means. And so if somebody says, I have a safety case, ask them, is it UL 4600 conformant? Yes, it's a yes, no question. None of this, well, kind of, sort of, yes, no. If the answer is yes, then all those questions you asked are covered. Interesting discussion, how deeply and how rigorously, but if the answer is no, you're kind of done with the discussion. It means they're just sort of waving their hands, and
It
who
seems like
knows?
they're just lacking a safety culture in the engineering departments of these companies.
Well, there are good people who are trying to really hard to do safety
But you
in
kind
all
of be
these
bred into
companies.
them, like before they even get there. Like, yeah, you look at a company like Airbus, for example. They're not just like, hey, we're just going to throw things out there and try it.
Well, that's where I'm going. So all these companies have good, well-meaning safety people. Some of them are really highly skilled. Some of them have sort of retreaded the careers, but you can get skills that way, so it's hard to say, right? They all have good, well-meaning safety people. The question is whether they're allowed to do their job, whether they get overridden. If you get to a company where according to public documents, Elon Musk makes the final decision on safety, and he can override people who say it's not safe, that's going to be a problem. In other companies, so then the other companies have independent safety advisory boards. And the question to ask is, so you have an independent safety advisory board. Cool. If they say
Yeah,
no, do you
that's the
still
problem.
ship? Those kind of questions don't get asked and don't get answered, right?
It's concerning. Is there a before I even ask, is there a way out of this? Because it seems like it's primarily going to be driven by capital decision if this happens. So there'll be a bad enough crash, something large enough where these guys go, oh, wait a second, let's step back. Our approach is probably wrong. We need to focus more on safety. I'm going to go back to that question I asked you. Can you tell me what safety is?
Yes. Let me
Okay.
answer the implicit question, then we can dive for a while into the other one. Sadly, our regulatory agencies are mostly created in response to having that one bad crash. Like the Grand Canyon crash, I think was NTSB, and there's always the one high profile crash, usually involving someone important. Politically, or something, the trains. It was we some of the train regulatory reform 100 years ago was because if I'm remembering correctly, there's a church picnic where a bunch of people got killed in an unsafe rail car. Right? There's always the galvanizing adverse news event that causes regulatory reform. And sadly, I'm concerned. I'd prefer this weren't this way, but we're on a path to waiting for that event to happen for the self-driving car industry, sadly. Now, we've seen some events kill individual companies, and it's a question whether each company is going to have their event and not survive it, or whether there's going to be something so bad the whole industry goes down. I would prefer the industry get its act together and avoid that event, but the funding and lack of regulatory incentives are sending them down a path that it's going to be company got by company or the bad one bad thing. That's the path we're on. I would love to see that change, but I haven't seen it change yet. So that's sad, but That's not just self-driving cars. That's just how technical system safety has always worked. And it can change. The aircraft industry got it together. They had FAA and they actually and NTSB and they actually take safety really seriously. And when we see the crashes or we see the Boeing 737 MAX fiasco, it's bad. But what's remarkable is that that's the one thing. It contrasts with the general safety culture of the rest of the industry, as opposed to, well, of course, that's just what happens, right? Which is what we see in automotive, sadly.
The wonderful world of AVs.
Yeah. So
Yeah,
what does
because
safety
I've
mean?
asked this,
Okay.
and the response I
All
get
right.
is some lawyer gobbledygook bullshit. So hopefully, you not being a lawyer.
Well, all right. So we're going to stay the heck
Thank
away from
God you
absence
win
of
the show.
unreasonable
Show's
reason.
over. We're done.
Okay.
Wait. Michael, we love you. Just wanted to make that clear.
I'm going to stay away from that. So, Michael, you can just head out to the Piggly Wiggly and go pick up a package of
Well
absence of unreasonable
played.
risk
Oh.
while I do this. Okay.
Good.
I had to get that in there.
Right,
Okay.
thank you.
All right. So let me go down. So I have a whole hour keynote that if folks can watch, they can watch me do this regularly. I'm gonna do it informally just to get the ideas out. But there's a list of seven things you have to do to be safe. And number eight is, and by the way, people have to think they would not have done better. That's number eight, because that's a non-technical thing. But there are several technical things. So I'm gonna go down the seven, then we can revisit, we can do whatever. I'll just read them off. One is positive risk balance, which is safer than a human. Number two is avoiding risk transfer. And that's like dumping your risk onto somebody else, right? Number three is avoiding negligent driving, reckless driving, things like this. Number four is you need to conform to safety standards, otherwise you don't
Okay.
actually know how safe you are. UL 4600, we just mentioned, that's what I'm talking about, right? Another one is you have to avoid recalls, which are a completely different risk and safety model than all the rest. Recalls are very different. Number six is a bunch of ethical and equity concerns. And number seven is, I think you need sustainable trust. And actually, sustainable trust does sort of get back to the people believe you're safe. And that's all, where all the squishy stuff
Okay.
ends up,
What do you
right?
mean? I want to.
So how do you want to go at this? It's like I
Yeah.
just rattled off seven things, and each one is like a
No.
half
A
hour
lot of
talk,
them
but
I
we're not
think are
going to do
pretty
that.
straightforward for our listeners. What do you mean specifically about the avoid recalls? Because you said that and Michael's nodding aggressively and I'm like I'm lost. Okay.
Let me go down the list
Sure.
so
All
we
right.
don't get too chaotic,
Great.
but then we'll stop and talk and then move on. So positive risk balance is safer than human driver. And the problem is, what do you mean by that? And what are the statistics? And you don't have a billion miles yet, so you're just guessing.
Right.
And we already had that discussion, but that's and but if you say, well, we killed twice as many people as a human-driven car, I kind of think that's a non-starter. So you have to be as safe as a human on the statistics, or else it will catch up with you and be a problem, but it won't be a problem today because it takes so long to find out how that turns out. Well, actually, if it's really bad, it'll be a problem sooner rather than later, but it's going to be a long time till you can prove you're okay. So it's not, they're selling on that, but it's actually, it's all downside, no upside. Number two is risk transfer. All right. So I'm going to give you a hypothetical, and I stress this is hypothetical. Okay. People say, but positive risk balance is all you need. What do you mean there's other stuff? Let me give you a hypothetical to prove that's not true. Okay. Let's say that you cut the fatalities by a factor of four. 40,000 people to 10,000 people die in the US every year due to car crashes because every single car is a robot. Every single car is level four, robotaxi, self-driving, whatever. People are always asleep in the back. Every single car drives itself. And you go from 40,000 to 10,000. First of all, the 10,000 is going to be a problem because why'd they die? But let's set that aside. What if all 10,000 are school kids in a crosswalk with their backpack walking to school? That's not going to be okay, right? Because that's more pedestrians than die. And by the way, all of them were super vulnerable. People are going to rebel. Now, I didn't say it was going to turn out that way. I just illustrated that who dies matters. And so risk transfer is if half the number of car occupants die, but the number of pedestrians who die doubles, even though the total number of fatalities went down, the fact that pedestrians are paying a proportionate increase in lethality is going
Well,
to be a
if it's
problem.
your AV company, I'm going to sell a lot of elephant masks because your car will avoid them. All right, sorry.
Well, no, it'll just turn over to the human driver who's not
Purpose.
expecting it, and then you can
Sorry.
blame the driver. No, we're not going there. That would never actually happen, to be clear. But the idea is that if you're lowering the total harm, but proportionally increasing the harm of vulnerable population, especially people who are not actually directly benefiting the technology, that's going to be a problem. That's another limit on safety. So people like, well, what's the acceptable risk? It isn't actually risk. There's a bunch of constraints of things you're not allowed to do. And when you meet all the things you're not allowed to do, then you can optimize safety further. So you're not allowed to dump risk onto vulnerable populations. That's just not going to work socially. Number three is avoid negligent driving. So again, thought experiment, not saying this would happen, just trying to sort of make the point. Let's say you go from 40,000 fatalities down to 1,000 fatalities. 40 times increase in safety. Who could not love 40 times safer? Every single fatality is a car blowing through a red light and running down a pedestrian. Okay? So that's negligent driving, negligence per se, Michael,
Okay.
right? Negligence per se, because you ran a red light and you killed someone. That's not going to be okay. Breaking the law and harming someone is not going to be okay. And if I'm a human driver, let's say, hypothetically, I drove 1 billion miles and didn't kill anyone. So does that give me a free kill? Because I'm, if I kill someone on purpose, I'm still
Right.
10 times better than average. What's the problem there? And when the robotaxi and self-driving companies, when all the self-driving industry says, but we're saving lives, why are you so upset at this thing? The answer is, if it's negligent driving, statistical goodness is not an offsetting consideration. If you broke the law and killed someone, you broke the law and killed someone. I don't care what you're driving. I mean, maybe I give you a lighter punishment in recognition of whatever, but you're not allowed to do that on purpose. So can't drive negligently. That's another constraint. So let's say I can make better time by running stop signs, but my LiDAR is so good I can make sure that I see everyone, so I will never hit anyone running a stop sign, I swear. Then you run a stop sign and hit someone. You don't get to say, but I saved so many lives, let me off the hook. It's like, hey, dude, you ran a stop sign, we're done. You can't, you're not allowed to run stop signs. You're just not. If you don't like it, let's have a nice legislative discussion to change the road rules. But until you do that, you're not allowed to break them
I
just
love
because
that
you think
argument.
you're
I've
smart.
saved all these lives because I haven't killed anybody. Look.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And therefore, right. So you can't drive recklessly. You can't drive negligently. And I know there's a lot of lawyer stuff there, but we're not going down that
Wait, but
rabbit hole.
just a question. Isn't it true that in almost every state where AVs are allowed, there's no legal mechanism for restricting cars that are going to run a stop sign and kill somebody? Isn't it just a question
It
of
is. It is.
whatever you can get out of a tort litigation, Michael? I mean, how do you really defend yourself against that, an AV running a stop sign and killing you? What is the defense?
You get a
Well, it's
citation
going
in
to be.
California.
Well, you have to sue whoever's responsible. You have to sue who's responsible, which is usually not the manufacturer.
Michael, what?
And in one state is the computer itself who has no resources, and you can't really sue.
So the laws are set up basically so that you're shit out of luck.
Well, I mean, we saw, we've seen recently California attempting to address, and we've discussed this a couple of times, attempting to address the problem of issuing citations to autonomous vehicles, which they're trying to establish a way of traffic citation approach to enforcement over autonomous vehicles. So if there is a negligent act, you would assume that the autonomous vehicle would be ticketed or be shown to be in violation the same way a human driver would be under those circumstances. And that violation would then allow for someone to, attribute negligence to the vehicle. So that's not something that every state has, but it's something that certainly needs to be in place.
But that accountability is
Yeah.
still a mess, and it's going to take years to work out because all of it, there's a bunch of laws that make it hard to get at the
Yeah.
manufacturer to hold them accountable. And that's presumably the intent of having written laws that way,
And
from
I
what I
think
can
it's
see.
suspicious that you're walking through intersections at night. What are you doing, Fred? What are you out there going, huh? Who are you interacting with? Who are your friends? What are you trying to buy? Huh?
Did Harry tell you about avoiding a tank? No,
Yeah,
we won't
okay.
do that.
We're not going to get in your avoiding a tank story. All right. Continue. What do we got?
Okay. So safety standards conformance, because if you're not following your own industry consensus safety standards, what are you even thinking? But unlike all the other industries I've worked with, the car industry doesn't have to follow their own computer safety standards. So the supplier chain does a pretty good job, but the manufacturers pretty much don't. And the self-driving car companies of various types, some of them are just outright disdainful of the standards. It's like, yeah, we took a look. We're a special snowflake. It's not for us. A couple have started saying, no, we're going to conform to UL 4600, and I really applaud that. But the industry still has a long way to go to following standards. Now, why is that? Well, if you have to wait 1 billion miles or 10 billion to see how it turns out, what do you just, we're going to do whatever and see how many people we kill and tell you how it turns out later? I mean, you have to do better than that. Now, the companies will say, will we follow our own rigorous engineering processes? I don't know what those are. In the past, when I looked at conventional car companies following their engineering rep processes, the processes were laughable. So maybe it's better here. Hard to say, but there's no accountability there. They're going to do what they're going to do. We're in a hurry. We're out of runway. We're going to make our decisions. We're so smart. It'll be fine. Trust us, right? Well, instead of that, you could follow your own safety standards. Now, it doesn't make guarantees, and certainly you can cheat and play games with safety standards. But if you at least say you're following the safety standards, then it makes you pay attention to things you're supposed to pay attention to. And it gives more accountability later, where if there is someone who's harmed, they can say, well, you said you followed your safety standard, and here's where you didn't.
Is the
Right?
difference
So
is,
they're,
sorry.
I mean, following safety standards, if you don't follow the safety standards, I don't know how
Is
you
the
can
difference
expect
is
to be
when
safe.
you see this with companies, is it companies that are more established versus newer startup ones? Because I'm just thinking from my own software experience, like large established companies, like before we kicked off a project, I remember sitting, we had the first day was like, this is how we're going to name classes. This is how we're going to name methods. This is how, I mean, it was an entire day of just like, here's the instruction manual. Whereas startups are just like, hey, I did something.
Typically, the startups go, we just got to get it working and we're going to do safety later. And there's a tremendous financial in deadline event. And I'm not happy with that, but it is what it is. And until they take into, we can talk about the effectiveness of safety drivers used to be more of a problem. Today, it's not, that's not a fight worth fighting. Until they take the safety driver out, whatever, okay? But when they take the safety driver out, they may be doing it because they're about out of money or they have a deadline. And what they'll say is, we have our own in rigorous safety standards because we have a bunch of smart people. We read all the safety standards. We put cooked up our own version, and it'll be fine. I don't want to judge that. Let me do this a different way, okay? You should expect to get what you incentivize. And if you incentivize meeting deadlines over safety, guess what you're going to get. Okay. If you incentivize getting on the road before you run out of money to get the next round of funding, rather than conformance with safety standards being a gate, you're going to get a safety standard that they, in their hearts, may think, yeah, that'll probably be good enough. Although most of them don't have enough safety experience and training to really know that. And CEOs who are like, yeah, I'm willing to roll the dice, right? That because that's what you're incentivizing. So why wouldn't you get that? Okay, so that's so that, they should be following their safety standards. There is varying conformance to safety standards, and the OEMs have the same issue. Their supply chains are usually pretty good at it, but the OEMs don't necessarily follow them either, and so there's a lot of messiness there. In Europe, they're just getting around. So in Europe, they're not actually required to conform to ISO 26262, which is the conventional safety standard. It's been out for more than a decade. They're starting to get, well, the assessors have to be trained in it, but that's not the same as conformance. So this is an issue for the traditional car industry as well. It's going to be decades before we get there. But the self-driving car industry is it's way worse. Okay, so the next one is
Yes.
recalls, right? So here's the thing. NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, who's the regulator for ground vehicles, does not. I'm going to generalize here, right? You don't see recalls from NHTSA based on not as safe as a human driver. You don't see that. You don't even see recalls based on high crash rate, because if you look at to the degree insurance data is predictive of safety, which is only weakly predictive, but if you see a car with 10 times the crash rate of another car, now some of that could be driver that it's hot rods, so drivers are acting unsafely. I get all that, right? But for sure, not every car is the same safety. For sure. But they don't recall on that. They recall on, here's a dangerous behavior this dark car displays, or here's a component that tends to fail that leads to danger, go fix it. So they're recalling for high, so like spikes in the risk profile. See that spike? Beat down that spike. That's a recall. So we're going to recall because you're running stop signs on purpose, not because, or we might recall kind of, sort of, because we think your drivers aren't paying attention, but even that one's squishy because it has to be something that's specific, that's fixable in a cost-effective way that people know how to fix. You know, there's all these requirements. So you could have a car that is saving lives. It's 100, every other criteria I mentioned, it aces every single one of them. But, you know, it just keeps running through stop signs. Even though it never hits anyone, it keeps running through stop signs. And NHTSA has in the past done a recall for running through stop signs because they just think that particular behavior presents unreasonable risk. So it's another dimension. All of these are, so you got the average fatality rate down, but you have these lumps and spikes and concentrations of risk. It isn't all flat. There's these bumps. And every one of these is a different take on, there's a bump, you're not allowed to have bumps on it. So the average has to go down or at least be no worse, but you're also not allowed to have identifiable clusters in risk. And recalls is one. So, and recalls, it says safety recall right on the label, right? Right on the tin, it says safety recall. So that's, to be safe, you have to have very few, if not zero, safety recalls. And for sure, once there's a recall, you weren't safe. You, by definition, you weren't safe until you fix it, until the remedy comes out.
Okay, now I understand that one. I was like, wait, are you trying to? Okay, got it.
Yeah. But you can have a vehicle that is objectively safe at a statistical basis and still full of recalls. There's no contradiction
there,
right?
One company, that's their advertising motto, right?
we're not going there. Okay, so number six is ethical and equity concerns, and I'm not talking about the trolley problem.
Thank you.
We're not going there. Everyone says, trolley problem, go away. That's not what I care about. But there are a bunch of ethical and equity. Equity are things, some of the risk transfer is equity. You know, you're saving lives, but it's only the lives of the people who paid, and you're actually putting other people in more risk, right? But also the companies are saying, well, you know, you should adopt robotaxis because they'll bring food to food deserts. You know, the ride-hail guy said that. It didn't really happen because those people can't afford the services, right? So there's a bunch of promises that are being made that there's no reason to believe they really come true unless there's regulatory pressure from PUC, and that's not happening. But there's also who gets to decide whether it's time to go on the road. It's the people who are worried about making money, not the people who are being the test subjects sharing the road with these things. So there's a bunch of ethical and equity questions, and that gets to be a long conversation, but there are some things that don't really look like all the others. Things like, are you blocking fire trucks? You have negative externalities on your risk. You're blocking fire trucks. Well, that doesn't show up in any of the typical risk calculations, right? But it's clearly a social issue. So there's a bunch of complexity there. And the last one is sustainable trust. And that is, I guess when I created this list, I hadn't thought of it this way, but this comes back to if people think you're dangerous, it doesn't matter what the statistics say. If they think it's a problem, and you have to get out in front of that and be trustworthy to the point that, there was a crash, but we told you there were going to be crashes, and here's the reason it's okay. And we told you all these things before the crash. We're not just making it up to cover ourselves. So that's my list. You have to do all seven of those things if you want to be safe.
I think that's
practice.
A great list. I like that. I think every single company struggles specifically with that last one because they're all saying, we're safer. That thing that went wrong.
Well, they try and define it as narrow as they can to make it easy to measure and easy to tell a story. Look, we're so many times safer. And that's actually, in the long run, it matters. To be clear, it matters. But in the short run, it's the least important metric.
That's interesting. But hey, I'm going to switch. This is my transition. Isn't AI just going to solve all of these problems?
Well, did we... I was going to ask, are we going to get to using all those seven things? How is it that we can put unregulated cyber cabs on the road? Since you promised everyone we were going to talk about that.
Yes.
All right. Let me do that one quickly. You know, all these things, there's a long rant on my Substack that people are welcome to read. So I'll do the quick one. All right. Okay, now this is, it's not Halloween, but for all the listeners, pretend that I have a flashlight pointed up at my face and I'm telling a scary campfire story, okay? But this is a way that if someone wanted to put unregulated robotaxis on the road and evade all regulation, there's a clear and obvious path to do it. And if you want to fault me for telling them how to beat the system, I have to assume anyone who wants to do this is at least as smart as I am and would have figured it out on their own. So this is more a cautionary tale so that other people, when they see it happening,
Fred,
they're
start
not
taking
caught by
notes for our
surprise, right?
cybercab company.
First one.
We can do this.
Yeah, you can decide which company it applies to. So here's the first one. And this one, people say, well, that's unrealistic. But you have to understand, the first step is not a means to the end. The first step is a step on a path, not the end, right? Okay. The biggest thing keeping robotaxis without steering wheels off the road is federal motor vehicle safety standards, which indirectly, not on purpose, but indirectly require steering wheel and some other things, right? Okay. Why? Because you have to measure how far you are from the steering wheel. There's no steering wheel, you can't measure it. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to replace the steering wheel in the vehicle with a touch screen, which is already there, right? And we're going to put a picture of the steering wheel on the
Perfect.
touch screen. And we're going to say that's the steering wheel. Okay, that's the steering. There's a steering wheel. It's right there. See, you can see it. It's that round thing on the screen. That's the steering wheel. Okay, and none of this has to be 100%. Oh, but it doesn't matter. Oh, but all they have to is just say assert it with truth. And now somebody, the burden is on regulators to prove that they're wrong. Right. So they're flipping the burden. Just like, we're just going to say it. And, they're going to have to deal with it. So this picture of a steering wheel is on the touch screen, and you can actually put your finger on the steering wheel and move it, and the steering wheel moves and it steers a car. So it really is a steering wheel. It really is. It really is a steering wheel, right? Okay. So there we go. Now, if you have a car that 99% of the time drives itself and you only need to drive it 1% of the time in benign situations, maybe that steering wheel is actually viable. Maybe that is actually a safe car. I don't know. Assuming the other stuff is safe, right? So you make that, okay, so you have a car with a picture of a steering wheel. Now you can self-certify that you've conformed to FMVSS because you measured the distance of the steering wheel. It's right there. You actually can do FMVSS and self-certify to FMVSS with no exemption. So people say, oh, they're going to do exemptions for robotaxis. Well, those don't help a big fleet because you only get so many exemptions, right? But if you self-certify to FMVSS, you don't need exemptions. You do as many as you want. Now, who would self-certify to FMVSS without a steering wheel? Turns out Zoox already did that. So I'm not making this up. Somebody already did this. This touchscreen steering wheel is unique. Every other step in here, people have already done, right? So we're FM, put the sticker in. We're certified to FMVSS. We're Robotaxis without a steering wheel. And I don't know what the rationale for Zoox doing theirs is. And it says investigating, and in however many years, we're going to find out how that turned out. But I'll bet if you put a picture of steering wheel in, it's pretty straightforward to
Love it.
self-certify. Okay? All right. So now I'm just pointing out this is a path you could take, right? So you self-certified FMVSS. That means you can go on the road. And by the way, you're going to add self-driving. Okay? You're going to put in whatever self-driving you already have that works most of the time, but not all the time. Now, to our previous discussion, you want to claim your level two so you're not regulated, right? The first regulatory hurdle is FMVSS, but you're just going to self-certify to the picture of a steering wheel. And the second one is, but you can't be level three or you're regulated. No problem, we're level two. Why are we level two? Well, because there's a remote safety driver. And at first, the remote safety driver actually has a steering wheel and they have a brake and they have accelerator. And they're watching the entire time for what happens. Okay? Now, this is literally what they're doing in China. So they're already doing that in China. That's how the robotaxis are in China. But then over time, as you gain confidence, you can say, you know what? He doesn't need a real steering wheel. He needs a picture of a steering wheel. So you give the remote driver a picture of a steering wheel and a button for brakes and accelerator. And eventually you say, you know what? We're just going to give him a big red button. And he presses the red button, the thing comes to a stop. It's like, well, boy, that costs a lot. Tell you what, we're going to give that remote driver two cars to monitor, four cars to monitor, 100 cars to monitor. And all he has to do is press the red button when he sees a problem because we have so much confidence in our technology. But we're going to claim it's level two because that remote operator is responsible for completing the object and event detection response subtasks. So that makes it level two.
Perfect.
Okay. And when there's 100 red buttons, what we're really going to do is the car is going to ask for help almost all the time. And the guy's just there to take the blame for not pressing the red button when he should. All right. So now you have a what is for all if you're a rider and you get into this, it's a robotaxi, right? For all practical purposes, you get in, there's no steering wheel. They took away the picture of the steering wheel because for certification it's there, but when it's under remote control, the picture of the steering wheel shows somewhere else. So it's fine. During FMVSS testing, the picture's there, so you pass the tests. And you don't show that picture, you're showing them a movie or the trip information or whatever, and there's a little tiny picture of the steering wheel in the corner, so it's still an FMVSS, whatever. Okay, so you're gaming that. And for all practical purposes, and that steering wheel better be disabled when there's a non-licensed driver in there, but it's there. Okay, so for all practical purposes, you're running a robotaxi, and there's a remote operator who's there to accept blame for not pressing the red button when they should, and probably they won't. If you believe in your heart that your stuff is safe, then you may morally justify to yourself that this is all okay. And then you put on a ride hail service. You put it on an Uber or a Lyft, and you say, but it's a level three remotely operated vehicle. What's the
I see
problem?
no problems.
So that's how you do an unregulated robotaxi without actually violating the letter of the law. You're
Yeah.
badly bending some of the things, but you're not filing the letter. And if you're a company who's interested in getting an IPO or near-term stock price, you do this, and it will be years, literally years, in our current political environment, maybe 4+ years, before the chickens come home to
And
roost.
we
Here's my farm up. That's my farm upbringing
And
coming
I'm going to
up.
put my remote operators in Pyongyang. So, good luck suing them. They're outside of the law.
Cuba works, and it's a
Sure.
shorter
Oh,
haul
yeah.
for the
Well, that'd
fiber
be, that's
things. Yeah.
my 24/7.
Venezuela. Pick your favorite non-extradition country, or but even if they're outside the U.S., how do you do a field sobriety test on someone who's in another time zone or another country or in a non-extradition country? What do you and what if those drivers aren't licensed? How do you even check their licenses? And in some states, I'll bet they don't
Sure.
have to
I
be
mean,
licensed.
and with the latency issues, everything will be perfect and safe. I like the fact that you put in there's going to be a big red
Well,
button because I think we've been asking
yeah.
for the big red button in these cars.
I didn't say that passenger was going to have access
Oh,
to it.
right. It's just my guy in Caracas.
Yeah. So what's the point of telling this scary story? Is that the robotaxi companies are all saying, oh, we can't deploy because of regulations. That's utter nonsense. They can deploy tomorrow if they want to. They're just using that as a dodge because they're not ready yet. But the other side of that same coin is they can deploy when they think they're ready, and the regulators really don't have much to say about it other than NHTSA can do recalls after the crashes have happened. It's about the only so the only checks and balances we have in our system right now are NHTSA can do recalls, and they're going to be challenged to do that. And in the new administration, it's going to be even more challenging to make any recall stick. We even see they did a recall on Tesla, and Tesla just sort of blew them off, right? We already saw that for Autopilot. And that was on the old administration. So recalls are a pretty blunt weapon. And the other thing you have is lawsuits. And lawsuits take years, and they're super expensive with this technology. And to the degree they require on product liability lawsuits, they're very, very challenging to launch. Really hard for an individual who's been harmed to do a product liability lawsuit. It's effectively out of reach in almost all cases. So there's not a lot of checks and balances left. Michael, I invite you to chime in on because I just went into lawyer land, but
Yeah, and it's
that's the
something
sense
we
I get.
talked about previously, I believe, when you and Bill were on, or when we talked about just the problem with proving that an AI is liable or that an AI screwed up. I mean, what kind of expert witnesses can you get to do that? And is it even possible to prove sometimes whether or not the AI is at fault?
And you can prove it behaved badly, but it might be that it's working exactly as designed and there is no design defect. Just once in a while, it does stuff like that, and that's state of the art. And then what do you do with
Well,
product
there's another
liability?
problem, which is that the AI processes are inherently opaque to human beings. So the only thing you can
Well, yeah.
do to figure out the relationship between A input and B output is a statistical test, just run over and over again, until you develop statistical confidence that it's operating the way you want to do it. There's no way you can linearly trace the input to the output.
And the argument you're going to have is, well, it stops at red lights 99.8% of the time.
Right. Yeah.
You can't prove it's 100, can't prove it's 100, and it's probably not 100 because it's statistical. And then the counter argument is, well, people don't always stop at red lights, so what's your problem? The problem is that we were promised that we'd be better than people, and it's going to make the same mistakes people make
So
just for
welcome
different
to the
reasons.
future, listeners. And in the future, everything will be better. We're looking forward to that.
But yeah, this is what I'm saying is that AI is solving all of these problems. I mean, this is what's going to happen. Actually, there was, I think it's, I don't know who it was. It might have been head of two different AI companies saying, "Hey, we've pulled in all of the data on the internet, and we ran out of data to train models off of." And it just pointed out to the fact that, wow, this is a lot more artificial than intelligent here. I mean,
Well,
large
and now
language
what we're
models
seeing
great
is
math, but.
that they want to cascade the AI solutions, right? So there's now somebody who wants to put an AI filter in between the cameras and the AI system that's figuring out how to drive the car. There's a tire company that wants to put an AI engine in place. And
What
what
could
could possibly
possibly
go
go
wrong?
wrong?
Yeah, and we haven't begun to really begun to confront the problems that introducing AI introduce into a safety chain or safety design. And now we're talking about cascading them three and fourfold in any individual vehicle as part of the overall operation. So what could possibly go wrong? You're right.
Well, we're getting towards the end, but there's one important thing about AI I want to say, which is there's a fundamental reason why this technology is so hard to get for safety, right? It's very fundamental and it's not going away. It has to do with what Fred was talking about. Anything AI, and by AI I mean machine learning, as opposed to the previous generations of AI I've used over the decades, right? Machine learning is statistical analysis. So statistics are really great for typical, usual, somewhat off, stuff that's in the training data. Yeah, there's 100 examples in the training data. It'll figure it out, right? He's just using a number. Okay. Machine learning and statistics in particular are bad at extremely rare events. And you can do things with extremely rare events under a bunch of assumptions that are simply not true of the real world. Gaussian distributions, please, that's not what you're going to see. Okay. And so, in fact, the challenge is long tail, in particular, heavy tail distributions, where there are a large number of rare events, but it's always a different one. It's always something. If it's not one thing, it's another. Okay, that's the heavy tail, and statistical approaches are the worst at that. Okay, so that's part one. Part two is safety. What's safety about? Well, if you can't drive up three blocks without hitting something, you're not even on the road. That's not safety. I mean, it is safety, but that isn't what we worry about. Safety with a competently engineered system always boils down to very, very rare events with extremely high consequence. Okay, so airplane crashes, they don't happen, but we pay attention because maybe 100 people die. Okay, so safety in a well-designed system is always rare events with high consequence. So you have machine learning, which is the worst at rare events, and safety, which only cares about rare events. And you're going to smush them together, and that's going to be a problem. So, in a nutshell, that's why safety is so hard, is because safety is all about rare events, and that's the thing machine learning is worst at.
The example you gave earlier of the Waymo not being able to identify a car being towed, that because it didn't follow, something in that model, right?
It wasn't in the training data. So edge case, people talk about edge cases. The definition I like for edge case is something that was not in the training data but matters, right? It wasn't the training data. It's a rare event. High consequence, they hit it, right? And there's for practical purposes, an infinite number of those, and it is very challenging to get those to happen infrequently enough. You're willing to suck up the residual risk. That is what the story of the robots. That is the story of the self-driving car industry for the last decade, and it's going to be the
Yeah,
story of
I think
them for
their
the
AI
next decade.
approach is just incorrect. I mean, someone needs to create an actual heuristic model that is similar to the brain.
Well, they think. They think if you pour enough tens of billion dollars, you can chase down that heavy tail and get enough that you're okay. And so far, they haven't really gotten, Waymo says they're there,
No.
but we know from our discussion, there's a lot more to it than that. So Waymo's busy chasing down that heavy tail by brute force application of money. They think they're going to get there. I'm skeptical because that heavy tail is a real bear. We're
Yeah,
come back
I
in
mean, I
5 years,
think if
see
you
how
can
it turned out.
ingest all the data that's on the internet, and have that, and you still can't get this right, I think there's a problem with your approach. Because there's no human that can come close to that, but we can all identify a car being towed at any angle with any light of sun
Well,
hitting it. It's fine.
so machine learning does not impute
Right.
common sense.
A
A
very
lot of this
simple
has to do with
heuristic
common
model. I
sense.
know they've been talking about that forever, and that's kind of, hey, we want to just do this, but it turns out that's really, really, really hard.
Machine learning doesn't give you the ability to have common sense. There's a whole different discussion there, but let's boil down to until you have common sense, you're going to struggle with rare events, and
And
they
I
don't have
want
common
to
sense.
stress for listeners, a rare event is something that, you know, a toddler can handle on a day-to-day basis.
People aren't perfect, but they're really impressive at rare, unusual events. I have my own list of personal stories that, if I weren't good at handling rare events, I
Right.
wouldn't be around. I'd be dead, okay? And everyone has their
Exactly.
stories, right?
Ah, well, hey, Phil, thanks for sitting with us for so long. This has been great. This is, I mean, now I want to bring you back for more AI in-depth stuff. And mainly, I just want to talk to you about submarines, but that has nothing to do with this podcast. Like, are you guys out there cleaning the sub? Like, is it Greg Barnacles and stuff? Anyway, that has nothing to do with this show. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you, listeners. And we'll be back next week.
Thank you, Phil. And for everybody who might have found this a little bit grim, I want you to know that right now, as we speak, there's a bluebird at my feeder in the middle of January. Makes me very happy.
Yeah,
Thank you
there's
for
a
listening.
fox sleeping. I've got a fox sleeping in my backyard. Who else has nature stories?
I have a bird feeder. That's about it. But thank you
Thanks,
so much
everyone.
for having me.
Thanks.
I really appreciate
Bye.
it.
Bye-bye.
For more information, visit www.autosafety.org.